Hello, and welcome to this first Blackwell Online podcast. My name is George Miller, and my guests on this program include Susan Greenfield, whose latest book, ID, looks at the quest for identity in the 21st century.
I think we are starting to sleepwalk into a crisis rather than teeter on the edge of one.
I've also been talking to Mark Lynas about his book 6 Degrees, which has just won the Royal Society Science Prize. It's a stark degree-by-degree look at our uncertain future on a warming planet.
The direction of scientific discovery seems to be that things are always worse than we originally thought, and things are changing within the planetary system itself more rapidly than the model suggested that they ever would. And you can see that in particular for the Arctic sea ice.
And I spoke to historian Mary Beard about whether there was more to the ancient Roman triumph than Hollywood films would have us believe.
And what the triumph does is elevate the general, celebrate Roman success, and also provide a vehicle for worrying about it and wondering about it. And for us, it provides a way of thinking about, I think, just how complicated Roman culture was against the popular image of its militaristic simplicity.
Later in the programme, I'll be talking to a Blackwell bookseller in Oxford about her pick of the best new biographies. But first, here's my interview with Susan Greenfield. Does her new book, I Wanted to Know, really suggest that our species is on the brink of an identity crisis?
I think on the verge of a crisis sounds a bit melodramatic. I think we are starting to sleepwalk into a crisis rather than teeter on the edge of one. It's only a crisis if we allow ourselves to sleepwalk. I think that it could just as easily offer huge opportunities for us as well as a crisis.
And various technologies are coming together to make it either a crisis or an opportunity.
Yes, I think the first thing to bear in mind is that those technologies have given us longer lives and more hours to each day. So the kind of issues that we face are not those faced in previous generations who didn't have the time, who just had to live and survive and stay warm and to eat and to look after their kids, and who are probably going to die in their 50s, say. So it's a crisis in the sense that it's unprecedented and that we're facing the stark and rather simplistic question of what we're going to do with our lives and what do they mean. And I think that the new technologies not only have freed us up to ask that question, but have also posed alternatives or exaggerations that weren't there for previous generations. For example, the screen life of two dimensions is posing, I think, a new influence or a new way of living that previously was only achieved by Wine, Women, and Song.
And you talk about malleability of the brain, and in a way that offers both, again, the blessing and the potential curse, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think that is indeed the starting point of my book, and something that, although neuroscientists are very familiar with it, the general public perhaps haven't really realised, which is they're very, very special. Each person is very special. They have a unique brain because no one, despite the fact that all their vital organs can be interchanged, no one has a brain like theirs, nor could it ever be interchanged. And no one in the future will have a brain like theirs because each individual brain, even if you're a clone, an identical twin, will have unique configurations of brain cell connections driven in turn by the unique individual experiences that people have. So if you reflect on that the brain is very dynamic but very sensitive to inputs, it means it's both exciting and threatening in equal measure.
So although the human body will not evolve, the patterns that the brain creates for itself are capable of changing remarkably quickly.
Yeah, I don't like the word evolve because that suggests evolution, and it's not that. It's a constant dynamism. That's what the brain does. It changes because what we do as a species is we adapt.
And you set out various scenarios of the way in which the human brain could develop in the future based on, you know, current trends and patterns. Can you say a little bit about what those scenarios are? That's perhaps a large question.
The scenarios are easy categories and they're broad categories, but nonetheless I think they're useful as different types of comparisons. The first is the someone scenario, which is that dominates in the West, or has for the last few centuries dominated in the West, where you are a someone, where you define yourself by how different you are to someone else, your status, literally your standing next to someone else. And the way you define yourself is by ideally conspicuous signs of superiority to someone else. So what you own, or sometimes what you do. And I even go as far as to suggest that the seven deadly sins are biological behaviors that are now out of context and have become symbolic to say something about you. So this sounds fine, but the problem is that if you define yourself in that way, then, as is increasingly the case, you feel that even though you might have the kitchen that says something about you, or the sneakers that are as individual as you are, your neighbour then has that kitchen and those sneakers, and you enter into a kind of arms race of individuality, which almost is paradoxical in terms. And as Oliver James points out in Affluenza, this increased material life has not led to happiness, in fact quite the reverse, and one in four people would be suffering from depression according to the World Health Organization. So the someone scenario offers conceivably a notion of individuality but no fulfillment. You then turn to the anyone scenario, which again has predominated for a long time, that of fundamentalist regimes, and these can be political, they can be religious, but they don't have to be religious, and certainly one can contemplate religion without these scenarios. Nonetheless, you know when the anyone scenario is predominating because it would be characterized by a constraint on what you do, say, think, wear, eat, and at the same time, the notion that the individual would be subsumed under the collective narrative. So the idea is that, yes, there is a narrative, there is a story there, just like there is for an individual, but it's not an individual life story, it's that of the ideology in question. And there, although that might be fulfilling, you're not individual. So that's not for many of us to be treasured. Then the third scenario, again, has been going since human beings stalk the planet, which is the idea of abrogating your sense of self or individuality into no one. And ever since we've had wine, women and song, or more latterly drugs and sex and rock and roll, people have enjoyed letting themselves go, losing their mind, blowing their mind. My question, though, is whether that's going to change, because that's neither fulfilling nor there's it's individual, but nonetheless we like to do it from time to time. My question is, given the advent of the screen, which I think mandates more that kind of hedonistic, experiential, momentary life, whether we might be skewing things more now towards that. So basically they're the three scenarios, none of which are ideal, because none of them offer fulfillment and individuality, which for me would be something that would be desirable. I just put that as a suggestion. It may be that everyone wants in 21st century society to be no one, to live this hedonistic world. If that's the case, we ought to make an active decision that's what we want, rather than just sleepwalk into it.
It did seem from the book that the no one scenario was the one which you personally felt was probably the most pressing concern. Mm-hmm. And I wondered who you felt bore the greatest responsibility for leading change or pointing out the dangers inherent in it?
Well, I would always say the neuroscientist, but then I'm obviously biased because I am one. But all neuroscientists can do is what I do, which is to say, this is how the brain works, as far as we know, and this is how a screen experience might change brain connections. We're not educationists, we're not sociologists. As one or two people have pointed out in reviews, I'm not an anthropologist, and I would have no claims to be. I'm a neuroscientist. What I bring to the party is to point out the malleability of the brain and to try and explain already trends that we might be seeing in terms of attention span, creativity, obesity, and so on, in terms of what I would suggest is a relationship between the impact of the screen on the brain. At the end of the day, it's always politicians that legislate. But politicians legislate when driven by focus groups and the media. And the media and the focus groups are driven by public opinion. And therefore, the more people that have these discussions like we're having this evening, one would hope that bottom up, that's what drives change and drives the way people are going to think about things.
Yes. And it seemed to me that educators bear quite a weight of responsibility, and that's not one they're yet really fulfilling.
Well, poor old educators are painted into a corner by the endless audits and constraints from which they suffer from central government. I think the lot of a teacher compared to, say, 30 or 40 years ago is very different, in that the educator can't just march into the classroom to say they're going to teach something in a different way, or they're going to teach a different subject, or they think that something's more important than something else. I don't think that's available for teachers as a choice, although I know there's concern among many as to exactly what they do in the classroom.
And where do you personally stand on the spectrum of optimism and pessimism about humanity's ability to forge some viable new model of behaviour and consciousness?
I think all scientists are optimists, and I'm very optimistic about our potential to do this. I think human ingenuity virtually knows no bounds, that we've done wonderful things ever since we've been on the planet, and especially in the last 100 years, we've done brilliant things with the technologies at our disposal. My pessimism lies in complacency or cynicism and negativity, and I think there is that side to human nature that they shrug and they sneer, and it's that complacency and lack of enthusiasm and lack of willingness to engage in debate. It's that depresses me more than our ability to change or our potential to change. It's a willingness or a motivation to do that, to be open to new ideas.
I was talking to Baroness Greenfield about her book ID, The Quest for Identity in the 21st Century, which is available now at bookshop.blackwell.co.uk, as are all the other books featured in this programme. My next guest is award-winning popular science writer Mark Lynas. Why, I wanted to know, is his book called 6 Degrees?